Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download at www.audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Over 100,000 titles to choose from for your iPod and MP3 player. Hello and welcome to The Drill Down, the podcast where we take a look at some of the week's most important events in tech and on the web and how they affect us all. I'm Andy Cersini.
I'm Dwayne DeFreitas.
And I'm Tosin Unofawakin.
This week, Amazon unveils the 3D interface Fire Phone and launches Prime Music. Google wants to go to space and keep you healthy. Tesla gives its patents away and drones that follow your every move. All this and more. As always, you can check out past episodes of The Drill Down, as well as the other fine shows in the Geeks of Doom podcast network, on geeksofdoom.com. Subscribe to us on iTunes by going to geeksofdoom.com, and you can leave us a review in our show notes. Join us on Facebook and Twitter at The Drill Down, and write to us at comments@thedrilldown.com. Our show is also on Stitcher at stitcher.com, and you can search for The Drill Down there. Let's just jump right into the hot stories of the week. Google is planning to launch a new health service called Google Fit to collect and aggregate data from popular fitness trackers and health-related apps, according to multiple sources with knowledge of the company's plans, as reported by Forbes. This kind of a service is a direct challenge to Apple's HealthKit, which launched earlier this month and is rolling out with the new mobile platform iOS 8. To aggregate data from wearable devices and apps. And also last month, Samsung unveiled Sammy, a biometric data platform that collects health information from devices and apps also. Google Fit will aggregate data through open APIs and will announce partnerships with wearable device makers at its upcoming I.O. conference. It's not clear whether Google Fit will be built into the next version of Android or if it'll be a standalone app that Android users can download independently, but looks like everybody's getting on the health tracking kick.
Yeah, you know, I look at this and I think to myself, as much as Apple, you know, surprised people with this, because they did do some surprising during WWDC, kudos to them. This has been more Google's foray than it has been Apple's. While Apple is saying, you know what, I'm not going to hop in directly to this whole fitness thing, fitness tracker, iWatch, whatever, I'm going to first lay out this HealthKit thing where everyone can use their own hardware and jump on and, like, we can all share data. And I've got the tie-in with, the hospitals and so on.
Yeah.
Google had already stated it was going to use its ability to crunch the numbers to try to attack debt. This was back at the end of September 2013.
Sure.
And this is the beginning of how you attack death. In an ideal world, I was at the doctor today, actually, and we were talking just about the technology they use. And, you know, when I presented the idea, what if whenever my heart went out of step, you got a notification if it happened like enough times to hit a threshold? Or what if, you know, there was just a whole bunch of blips on a screen that represented everybody, and when they went out of whack, based on whatever we can track, you guys knew? And she'd be like, that would make her nurse practitioner jobs so much easier. But more than all that, you know, Google's already on this wearable side. Google's already pulled out the stops on this wearable thing. And they're, you know, they've been working, you know, Samsung's been using, their S line, which is a Google Android operating system, to tie in with their Tizen based, devices. So Google's kind of been here for a while. We'll really see what happens at I.O. I have a feeling that they're going to have a solution that is going to be totally head-to-head with what Apple offers.
Sure.
If not a little bit more built out. I'm not saying that Apple's not going to have a good thing going. I'm just really happy that these guys are now trying to get into this game. But what I'm really surprised at is that Facebook didn't do this first. They're already a place where people are comfortable sharing their information, where people are comfortable laying things out. If Facebook had a private dashboard that talked about how you've been posting and what you've been doing and whatever, and allowed you to see your own stats from your Fitbit device, your Jawbone, whatever, people would have adopted that a long time ago.
And
with their user base, they would have had no trouble communicating to these different companies to get it done.
You think maybe they were reluctant to jump into this yet because of the the bad will that they've gotten for all of the privacy violations in the past.
They've done so much to work that out. I think that they would have had a good shot at doing that if they had mentioned this last year at F8 or something. Especially if they had said, laid out the fact that it's all sandboxed and that it's a private dashboard. What Facebook really needs to get people motivated again, I think, is the ability to see what you've been doing on Facebook in a quantified self kind of manner that is private. Facebook essentially needs a dashboard, and throwing your health information in there is second nature. So I really gotta say, I think that with these bigger guys jumping on this, Facebook has dropped the ball. This is where they really could have been. They could move from a place where you just post pictures to a place where you track yourself. And that's what you think of when you think of the open graph, right? When you think of what Facebook is all about.
Well, you know it's got to be coming. If Google's doing it, Apple's doing it, Samsung's doing it, Facebook's got it. Can't be that far behind.
It's like everybody's a car company. They just copy one another.
Yeah. Yeah. More or less. And I think this is great. I mean, you're right. Google versus death. This presaged everything that was announced this week with the Google Health. And I think, I mean, this is just a natural extension to everything that they're doing to use data to get involved in every aspect of our life.
Yeah. What's really interesting, though, is that the marketplace now for these fitness companies is very different. There could have been a time when a Facebook, a Google would have purchased a company like Fitbit. But they're essentially saying, we're not going to take a bet on your proprietary stuff.
Right.
You're going to sink or swim on your own, but we're going to make sure that everybody can access it in an aggregated way on our platform. So if you were one of those other guys and you were thinking, okay, I'm going to put myself in a position to be picked up by Apple, by Google, by whatever, it's pretty clear now that these guys, these bigger companies, they don't want to pick up your solution. They want to pick that up as an acquisition for $500 million, $1 billion, $20 billion, whatever. They literally want you to do stuff on your own, and they just want the data.
Yeah,
it is kind of interesting that we are, in maybe the year of the health kick, because I'm sort of curious, if we had to poll average. See, I don't want to just say American, because this
the
is
average.
A,
I think you
got to
talk about the average
initiative.
Millennial. I think you got to talk about the average millennial, the average city living millennial.
How important do you think these innovative health approaches are going to be to their lives?
This is a good question. Before the show, Andy and I were talking about pictures and the things he does to get them on the cloud, and I thought I was like, Muggles just don't do that. I don't know how many Fitbits have been sold. I don't know how many Jawbone Ups or, why things devices have been sold. But I do think that there's a reason the traction that's showing up here is real. And I think as time moves forward, the health-based devices, these fitness, let's call them fitness devices, fitness tracking devices, they're going to be integrated into more and more regular stuff. I don't know if we'll see specialized hardware in the future. I think we might see it's built into a watch, it's built into a phone, that kind of thing. And so that biometric data is going to become more and more important. And especially with Obamacare and the way the insurance companies run, insurance company right now, today, like Allstate, can have an advertisement where selling you on if you put something in your car so they can track every move you make, and every move you make is a good move, your insurance will go down. It's easy to see that model applied to health insurance, so that over time, because health costs are going up, or health insurance is going up, in order to bring health costs down, hey, look, we're going to monitor what you eat and how active you are, and because of that, your insurance is going to go down. I can see this becoming a bigger thing in the long run. But right now, I don't think it's completely mainstream. I think it's mostly streamed, but not mainstreamed.
The Google versus death article brings up an interesting thing, which is, we're talking about conquering death, but what it is really, it's about knowing ourselves. You know, if we have diagnostics on our own daily activity and we're able to regulate that activity in response, no matter who makes it, Google or Apple, or no matter who allows us to be able to do that, it can only be a positive.
We look at this technology and we say, oh, look, it's technology. But the first really important technology is the way your body is your body. You know, you are a machine. We're a thinking, loving, you know, alive machine. But that aliveness has much to do with the way your hardware is performing. And if we can monitor that hardware, we begin to approach what I said last time when we were talking about WWC and HealthKit. This moves toward that singularity. How many studies are being done in clinical trials right now? How many studies are being done looking at what happens if we do this, do that, do this other thing? Imagine if you had all the adults in America being tracked, and that data was open access to every health research firm, and it was all aggregated, anonymized data. You'd be able to look at the health benefits of certain lifestyles quickly, and you'd be able to find correlations and even causations pretty soon. And that's where things get exciting, because the exponential gain in wellness from that kind of data is going to be phenomenal. It's just a question of making sure we don't commercialize it to a point where it's people are in that Minority Report situation walking through a mall getting hit up with ads.
I hope not.
Your heart rate's high. Why don't you try this shake?
Yeah.
Sounds like Futurama, right?
That is the inevitable conclusion.
Well,
I
let's
feel.
Not call that.
That would be the.
Let's have some hope.
I think that's exactly what people are afraid of with someone like Facebook getting into the health kick.
On the whole, they've been pretty good about how they've been able to lock data down and not use it. And what advertisers see is less about you as Andy Cercini, but more about people who have been grouped into the same group that you're in based on your activity.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that they haven't been able to communicate that effectively, I don't think, which is why so many people are still got the bad taste in their mouths, you know? You look at a company like Toyota who had these crazy recalls for mats and acceleration and crashing, and they haven't seen they never saw a better year than last year. That was 2011. It's 2014. 2013, they saw their best year ever. So it's, you know, that company is an example of how to get around that issue. Facebook's issue, you know, they've been plagued by this thing because they made a couple brash statements maybe 4 or 5 years ago. They allowed a couple of changes in their privacy policy to look a little more alarming than they actually are. And, man, they've just been plagued. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So no trust there.
Speaking of Google, Google's also in talks with Virgin Galactic about a deal that will hand it crucial access to satellite launch technology and an equity stake in Virgin Galactic. The talks are likely to lead to a deal with two main elements. The first will see Google inject hundreds of millions of dollars into a joint venture with Virgin Galactic, folding in the technology it's developed as part of its efforts to build the world's first space tourism business. And the second will involve Google spending roughly $30 million in return for a small stake in the Virgin Galactic holding company.
This is cool. I feel like you look at, what SpaceX is trying to do with the NASA contract and what they've attempted to do but kind of failed with the Air Force contract. And I see what Google has to offer in terms of analytics and understanding. And I really feel like it's possible for – I mean I wonder why Google is going to go for this rather than the SpaceX connection. But, you know, that said – competition in this space is key, and if Google and Virgin Galactic, which has kind of been vaporware for the last little while, can get along and find something viable for the consumer, I mean, like, that's great. I want to be in space.
All right, let's move on here. Here's an article that you linked me to, Dwayne. Priceline has agreed to buy restaurant booking service OpenTable for about $2.6 billion in cash. OpenTable charges restaurants fees to book diners on top of monthly fees to use its software. Priceline has taken over travel sites like Booking.com and Kayak.com and is looking for new ways to keep profits growing. And this merger extends Priceline's customer base to include the 15 million people who use OpenTable each month.
Yeah, OpenTable is a really interesting product. I actually have a close friend who was an early salesperson for them, and the technology, what they are is a technology. Right? Yeah. As much as they're a booking service, the technology is this booking service. They're a technology company with an incredible business development team that's been able to, frankly, go out there and sell restaurants on the idea of this not quite seamless web, but have people book a reservation and get in there from, you know, from their phones or from their computers or whatever. And the restaurants have seen some benefit. There has been some controversy, like, man, I got to keep a table open for OpenTable, yeesh, that kind of thing. But they've been very good at working with the restaurants to make sure that everything's profitable. And they've done what needs to be done, which is to get people booked in seats so that the servers can actually go out there and sell you, upsell you on drinks and other things like that. Mm-hmm. And that's key. So Prime buying them is interesting because Priceline, everyone thinks Priceline, they're not thinking Priceline Group, they're thinking Priceline the service, where, you know, you've got William Shatner trying to get you to bid on a hotel room or something like that. Priceline Group is highly diversified in entertainment and accommodations, hospitality, let's call it. So this is a good fit for them. They've got Booking.com. They've got Kayak, which is one of the best things out there for finding flights and hotels. And I think this is going to help them. While they're not going to roll this into their other services, it's going to help them keep an eye on, frankly, the data around how people purchase non-material goods. Priceline is going to have an essential role in aggregating and understanding that data and being able to provide that data back, not necessarily to advertisers, mm-hmm. but to the service runners themselves. So we have a new – not a new, but a very different model than what we normally think. We think the Apple and Samsung guys, they make products, they sell them, they make money off the products. We have the Google guys. They make digital products, they sell them, they make money off the advertisements. With Priceline, they basically go out to other, you know, vendors of non-hardware goods, services, and they say, we're going to, you know, send leads your way or send bookings your way, and what we're going to do is you're going to pay us for those bookings. But on the other side of the equation, they're looking at how everyone's doing these bookings, and they're going to have this nexus where they can determine how to make these experiences better for us. And then go back to their vendors and say, guys, here's a new way of doing things. Here's a new way of doing things that is going to get more people more interested, and it's going to be easier for everyone to get in your stores and grow your profitability. Mm-hmm. So it's a very kind of interesting landscape. It's a different kind of technology than what we normally talk about, but I think it's pretty compelling because this stuff is key. I mean, how often have you gone to Hipmunk or Kayak or whatever to buy stuff? And now with OpenTable, the ability to just kind of like pop open your phone and get a reservation at you know, a sweet restaurant is a pretty good thing, especially because a lot of sweet restaurants you've got to wait in line for, or you've got to like get on your name on the list and then find something to do for 40 minutes before you can sit down. OpenTable really gets you right there, and that's pretty exciting. $2.6 billion is a lot of money.
Yeah.
Once again, we're in the billion tier of billion plus tier of purchases.
Yeah. Does this not? So here's the thing that gets me worried about this. I'm not. I don't think it's too crazy that if Beats sold for $3.2 billion and Nest sold for $3 something billion and Motorola sold for $3 something billion, that OpenTable sells for 2.6. I mean, I think it's a little high compared to the value of some of those other companies. When I look at what happened with Snapchat, I worry. Because even though Instagram and Tumblr each sold for $1 billion, just software companies, and these companies with software and hardware have sold for, you know, in the $2.5 to $3.2 billion range, I still don't quite understand why Snapchat is worth $16 to $19 billion.
Maybe like, they've, you know, it could be that there is a larger plan that they have for the company.
I mean, Google's buying companies that have satellites in space for less money.
Yeah. Or it could be just that Facebook's, you know, saw the writing on the wall, saw that everyone who was on Facebook is now on Snapchat and other ephemeral services. And they're
wants to buy back the user base.
Exactly.
Yeah, I just feel like $19 billion is. I mean, the idea that they couldn't go for $10 billion. I mean, think about it this way: $16 to $19 billion, right? Even if we go conservative and say $16 billion, you're telling me that they wouldn't have sold Snapchat for $10 billion.
$6 billion less. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Or,
oh, yeah.
Even
oh,
more
yeah.
conservatively, you're telling me that they wouldn't have sold it, the guys who own Snapchat wouldn't have sold it for $6 billion, which is twice as much as every single top-tier acquisition, the twice as much as the most expensive top-tier acquisition we've been talking about. You're talking about Nest, Motorola, you know. Sure. These guys sold for $3 billion.
Well, I don't know the
Snapchat
details.
Snapchat wasn't worth twice that. Instead, Snapchat was worth, you know, five times that.
I'm not privy to the details of the deal, but I think the Snapchat guys were pretty savvy to either hold out or, you know, ask for that in the first place.
I know I'm not the brightest guy in the world, but I just can't wrap my head around where that value is. And when Facebook has to talk about their annual report and they've got to talk about their write-downs, the idea of a $19 billion purchase of a company that connects people via what's effectively fancy iMessage seems difficult to justify in the current landscape. And if it's not difficult to justify, if everybody else is undervalued, then we're going through some weird tech implosion instead of a bubble.
Yeah.
Well, you are more than welcome to buy my personal services for $1 billion. So, I'm just laying that out to any listeners.
What are your
out
personal
there.
Services? I'm worried now. Does this involve the Silicon Valley math?
Well, I mean, somebody just sold an app that all the app does is say yo.
For $1 million.
That's yeah. all it does.
Really?
Yeah,
wow. Yeah. The okay. Yo app, it was all over the news today. It's Wednesday, and the Yo app sold for – well, he got investment of $1 million for an app, and when you open it up, all it does is say yo.
I'm going to start building apps. You guys ready?
Yeah, I'm in. Whatever. I'm in.
Yeah. Oh, you know what? Big thing. We've been talking about Snapchat. I meant to say WhatsApp.
WhatsApp.
Right. WhatsApp. Snapchat has not been –
purchased.
Sold.
Yeah, it's the WhatsApp. I get confused all the time. WhatsApp is the thing that Facebook bought for $16 to $19 billion. And yeah,
Snapchat's holding out for more money because they were offered, was it $4 billion?
They were offered $3 to $4 billion and they said no thanks. And that was from Facebook. But I doubt that Facebook is gonna buy them for $16 to $19 billion. So
And I was thinking in my mind about Instagram. That's what I was thinking when I was thinking about what Facebook had bought for billion
dollars. So the $1 billion for Instagram, I mean, it's not easy to see, but, you know, fantastic, good, you know, fine. You start looking at these companies like Nest, who's building something, who's got all these, you know, product line and everything, you know, $3.2 billion. You look at Motorola, they build phones. $3 billion, right? You look at OpenTable, you know, they've got inroads into all the, like, building the network of restaurants they have is completely hard. And having that, the back end work as seamlessly as it does, is also pretty difficult. You know, I could see the billions of dollars there. Beats, right? Apple jumping in there, getting their hand on the hardware, getting their hands on the sentence architecture for the AI for building playlists on the fly, you know, $3 billion. I could see that, you know. It's just when I see that $16 to $19 billion number, it just boggles me. I'm still boggled. I can't comprehend those numbers.
Yeah,
I digress.
Just put it in terms of how many R2D2s you could build or buy.
You could probably build one actual one for that much money.
A fleet.
You could probably build one real R2D2, like completely autonomous, long, long time ago, galaxy far away R2D2 for $16 billion.
With rocket boosters and all.
With rocket boosters and all, and oil to shoot out, just in case it comes in contact with a super battle drone.
All right, moving on. Apple reached a settlement with U.S. states and consumers seeking damages over the company's fixing of electronic book prices, avoiding a trial in which it faced as much as $840 million in claims. The trial set for July involved cases related to a ruling last year that the company had orchestrated an illegal scheme with publishers to raise ebook prices. We cover this on the drill down.
Yeah, we have. The idea here is that instead of going back to trial,
they ran over to everybody who would have been involved and said, let's pay out. So we don't have to go through this trial. It's going to hurt our face in terms of PR.
Yep.
And because it's going to be cheaper to settle with you. And it's interesting because we all know, I don't know if you guys have heard about the Amazon Hachette situation right now.
Sure.
But Amazon was very much behind the DOJ chasing down Apple on this issue because Apple stepped into the electronic book selling market, which is Amazon's domain, and Amazon said, no, not the way you want to do it. Now we look at what Amazon has done in this space, and if you go to buy a Hachette book,
yeah,
you can't get it, the physical book. You can get the ebook, but you can't get the physical book. They say, 1 to 2 months to delivery, et cetera, et cetera. And that's because Amazon is working pretty hard to strike a deal. And this is how they leverage the deal, by saying, we're just not going to sell your book, even though we're the number one online book retailer in the world. So it just goes to show that when it comes to the way business is run, it's not necessarily like there's a – it's not necessarily that there's a there's necessarily a good guy and a bad guy. These guys are all just trying to do their best to make a buck from a scheme that they think is the better way to do it.
They're just trying to get paid.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Which reminds us of our conversation we had earlier about, AT&T's and the various other vendors. It's all about the money.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's hardcore.
Damn the consumer.
Pretty much. All right, let's take a moment to talk about our sponsor, Audible.com, the world's leading provider of digital spoken word entertainment on the internet. For the listeners of the Drill Down podcast, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a free 30-day trial to give you a chance to check out their service. And the book I'd like to mention this week is called Our Mathematical Universe, My Quest for the Ultimate Nature of Reality by Max Tegmark. Max Tegmark is a professor of cosmology at MIT. And what's interesting is he has a hypothesis that our physical reality is a mathematical structure. And he's got a theory about the ultimate multiverse that goes with that. In a dazzling combination of both popular and groundbreaking science, he not only helps us grasp his often mind-boggling theories, but shares with us some of the often surprising triumphs and disappointments that have shaped his life as a scientist. Oh, this is an interesting book. I like books that propose theories, like these global theories, existential theories like this, like perhaps that we are all a mathematical structure, that is what the physical reality is. In a way, it really is.
Well, I mean, if you haven't already seen Neon Genesis Evangelion, you would know that we're all just one big blob of math.
Right. I mean, essentially, the world is ruled by mathematics.
The universe.
Well,
the universe can be explained through mathematical expression.
Yeah.
Which is a different thing to say than we're ruled by it. So we can account for our observable understanding of the universe through mathematics. That doesn't necessarily mean that we're all mathematics. In fact, when we look at things digitally, part of the problem is that the world is an analog. So our math can't actually conceive the world properly. Like, we can't conceive of a minute exactly.
It's like trying to see 4D with our 3D viewpoint.
Exactly, exactly. So, I mean, this sounds like a great read. I mean, I'm actually excited to kind of check this out because I love thinking about this sort of reality, understanding reality.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know what else is really cool about Audible? Have you guys tried Audible's Whisper Sync?
No, I haven't.
I'm aware of it. I have not tried it, only because I haven't bought a Kindle book that I also have an Audible copy of.
I mean, this is astounding. You buy the ebook on Kindle, and if you add narration, and you have it on your Audible situation, and when you're driving, it will read the book to you, and when you pick up your Kindle from your iPhone or whatever. When you pick up your Kindle or your iPad or whatever, you open that Kindle app up and you go back to the book, you will start reading the paper or the e-paper or whatever from where the Audible left off. I mean, that's holy grail. I mean, if you're not in the Audible,
that's the future.
I mean, it's not the future. It's here. Jeff Bezos gave it to us before the Fire Phone. And if you have
haven't tried this out, it's worth giving a shot. And the best way to give a shot is to just hop over to audible.com/thedrilldown, get your free book, you get to keep it anyway, and then hop over to Amazon and try to pick it up on Kindle. And, you know, that's you'll be able to check this out, and it's yep. one of those great things. And you'll be helping Amazon understand that you like the show and, you know, help them keep on liking us.
Absolutely. So, again, that site is audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Free audiobook, 30-day trial to check out their service. And like Dwayne said, even if you don't like the service, you can cancel it and you can keep the book for free. So there you go, Audible. That's the way that I read books these days. I'm reading a great one too, and I'll put it for next week's show. But it's a really fascinating one. I'm not even gonna tease it. Just gonna say it's really fascinating, and we'll talk about it next week. All right, we're gonna take a little break here, listen to some music, and when we return. Why would the most successful electric vehicle maker give away its patents? Take a listen to this and come on back.
Well, I saw Patacron, but I'm out on the road again. I'm on the road again. Well, I'm so Patacron, but I'm out on the road again. I'm on the road again. I ain't got no woman just to call my special friend. You know, the first time I traveled out in the rain and snow, in the rain and snow. You know, the first time I traveled out in the rain and snow, in the rain and snow. I didn't have no pharaoh, not even no place to go. And my dear mother left me when I was quite young, when I was quite young. And my dear mother left me when I was quite young, when I was quite young. She said, Lord, have mercy on my wicked son.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to The Drill Down on Geeks of Doom, the roundtable podcast where we take a look at the best in tech and on the web and how it affects us. I'm here with Dwayne DeFreitas and Tosin Anafwakin. Last week, Tesla Motors CEO Elon Musk wrote a blog stating that the company would not initiate lawsuits against anyone who wishes to use their technology in good faith. While the wording of that statement is too ambiguous to be interpreted as a declaration that Tesla is going to make its patents available to anyone who wishes to see them for zero license fees, it does hint at the possibility that the automaker is willing to offer license to license its technologies on reasonable and non-discriminatory terms. 4 days after Musk's post, Nissan and BMW announced that they are keen on talks to cooperate on charging networks, which pretty much validates why Tesla freed up its patents in the first place. They want their superchargers, their electric vehicle chargers that they've got, like a network of 97 of them across the...
Charging stations.
They want those to become the industry standard, making it more and more feasible to swap fuel-burning cars for battery electric ones, even for long-distance travel.
Yeah, so this is interesting for a couple of reasons. We can talk about patents till the cows come home, but Greg T. Davies and I went on and on about what this means for the worldwide patent war. It's it's inflammation and it's eventually de-escalation, and this is a big piece of it. But I think what's more important for the drill down listener is the idea that for Tesla, the ability to look at their patents versus the ability to create a vehicle like the one they've created are very different things. Looking at a patent will tell you, hey, yeah, you know, this is how they did it. Great. But actually being able to put together a vehicle like the Model S, a vehicle that on the oatmeal last week, he made an entire complete comic based on it.
He calls it
his super space car wonder dream or something. Uh-huh. And the idea is that the engineering behind it isn't just the patents. The patents are the fundamentals of how the technology is derived. But making the seats, stitching the seats is beautiful as you do it. Making the car so that you can put four Model S's on top of a Model S and the roof will still be intact because it's that strong. making it so that it can go from 0 to 60 in 4.2, anywhere between 4.2 to 5.7 seconds, depending on which model you have. I mean, these are the things that you're not going to get by looking at a series of patents. These are the things you're going to get by having great and wonderful engineering and design teams. And Tesla has that, and it's not something that he's worried about losing. So when he looks at the BMW i8 and he giggles because it's not a great car, it costs $30,000 more for a base model than his top-end car costs.
Yeah.
And it doesn't have – it's not as fast. It doesn't have as long range. It just has a BMW badge on it. He's like, look, I'm not worried anymore. In fact, I want to encourage more people to build more electric cars. My focus is getting gasoline cars off the road as quickly as possible, which is why I started this company. And if we can get more people out here to do that, then so be it. And I think that is the most wonderful way, you know, allowing these patents to become licensable in this easy way. This is the most profound way to get more people on the ball. The only people upset about this are patent lawyers who were hoping for litigation.
I think patent lawyers and I'm sorry, Tosin.
Oh, no, go ahead.
I was going to say patent lawyers and anyone with a competing charging station format.
Yeah, even those guys. Okay, so if you have a competing charging station format, on some level you thought to yourself, all right, I'm going to have to build these things and that's going to cost me money. Now you can say, you know what, I may have – I don't know how many other – I mean, like if you're Nissan, right? I may have 3 million cars out on the road. But the fact of the matter is in my next revision, I can make it work with Tesla.
Yeah.
And then I can sell 12 million cars. And I can probably sell so many cars that I can sell separately a conversion package kit adapter for anyone with a Leaf currently that doesn't use a Tesla-style technology. And they'll buy it and they'll use it. You know, or I can just, you know, recall them and refit them, whatever. But the bottom line is, if there is a standard, you will sell more cars. Now, frankly, I have this impossible dream that the standard isn't about recharging your car in 20 minutes, but it's more about driving your Tesla onto the supercharger, a machine hand coming out of the ground, sucking down your battery and swapping a new battery or a recently recharged battery in, and then just driving off. That is the holy grail for me, 'cause that takes no time. And it means that we're not concerned with the battery attached to the car. We're not concerned with, oh, how many miles does your battery have or how many charge cycles does your battery have? You know, that's all being managed by the Tesla infrastructure.
Yeah, they are starting down that path, right? They have that technology. They've placed a few of those around. But now leaving the patent issue, as it may, you know, like you said, there's going to be more companies who are going to invest in this technology, and that will ultimately be positive for Tesla when it comes to, you know, having more global infrastructure. So now it's not just their specific locations. There are more locations, more organizations are spinning up that really support electric cars and allow them to get more sales and probably even in general also allow them with some of the legislation that they've had issues with when trying to sell their cars in other locations. Now there are more, you know, vendors in that sort of space. I think the other positive, of course, is, you know, of course, for Tesla, you know, it's not really ultimately often it's not really about the patent. It's more about the engineers you have, right?
So that's what I was saying.
This is a positive marketing move for them.
It's PR at its best. This man knows what's up when it comes to making his company look like the rock star it is. Yeah. There's also the idea that if everyone and their mother starts making electric cars, they won't, you know, again, the engineering in Tesla is so great that Tesla can remain the engineering leader in these electric cars. Tesla is a technology company that happens to make cars, and when it comes to the car market, Tesla has that Samsung Galaxy series, that Apple iPhone series level of vehicle. It has the high-end car. No one is touching this vehicle when it comes to awesome. So everyone can go out and make their own vehicle. You know, GM's going to make one, but GM's going to say, I want to make one that costs $20,000, $30,000 so the average person can buy it. And while Tesla's like, I may get there one day, the speed at which I get there is going to be a lot less. I can barely get as many, you know, 37,000 Tesla Model S's, and those things cost between 57 with rebates to 107 grand. 37,000 of those are on the market. They've outsold all of the current version of the Mercedes S500 and the 7 Series BMW combined. And he still can't get them out fast enough. So if he wants to change the world, he's going to have more of these vehicles out there. And, you know, you just can't do it alone. And that's why this is going to be a big thing. And as those guys like the Nissan Leaf and, you know, say opposed to Toyota or whatever jump in here, it's going to be one of those things where his brand is elevated by everybody else's not as good electric car that's coming up.
Although I think that and we've sort of covered this, that this is not Tesla's primary motivation for doing this is patent law reform. But you have to admit that it is quite a blow for it if this sets a precedent.
Well, so, okay, the worldwide patent war had to do with the fact that there was an explosive new paradigm of technology and everyone was angling to get on it. And again, you can always check out earlier this week's version of the Blendover. But what really happened was Steve Jobs went from Xerox Park to making macOS, and he made it well. Yeah. And then Bill Gates effectively took that paradigm and flushed it into Windows 95. Fantastic operating system that blew everything away. Not because it was better than Mac OS X, but because it was on a platform that was already adopted by everybody else. And when Steve Jobs saw what Android was doing with the iPhone, he was afraid that this brand new paradigm that he created would be taken over by Android and a platform that, you know, the platform would be adopted by everybody because it was cheaper. It was being offered for free. We've all seen that before with Internet Explorer. And he decided to declare nuclear war on all things Android. And you know, now that he's gone and Tim Cook's in charge, we have things like USB 3 ports on a MacBook and, you know, that kind of thing. But we also have a de-escalation of this patent war as we realize that this capacitive multi-touch display technology is going to be the new paradigm for the post-PC era. And it's better for Google and Apple to work together on patent reform and possibly even later on sharing information. Than it is for them to go at it head to head, you know, having this crazy war of attrition legally. So that's like really what happened. So you look at that, and there are a couple of, you know, federal Supreme Court cases and other things, and there's a de-escalation of these hostilities, especially because patent trolls have been found out by the courts to be jerks. And the court's like, since you're jerks, we're going to make it really hard for you to do some of these lawsuits that you do every day. So I think Tesla throwing this out there also goes to show, like, look, patents are not for profiteering. Patents are to protect your profits, but not for profiteering. And I think that really flies in the face of what a lot of IP lawyers would like to hear.
Yeah, well, I'd love to see the era of the patent troll dead and gone.
Yeah. Yeah. And again, these patents are important. Back in the day, there were no patents, and Stradivarius made a whole bunch of violins. Now it's suspect as to whether his violins actually sound better than new violins, but it doesn't matter. Everybody wants one. They're $3 million a pop. It's incredible. And no one can make one the same way anymore because there were no patents back then because the information wasn't available on the technique.
Right.
And that's what patents are supposed to protect. And Tesla's saying, yeah, the information's available. Go ahead, use it. If Stradivarius were around and he felt that he had the protection, the way Tesla has the protection, he may have done the same thing.
Yeah, I'm sure. Okay, moving on from here. Amazon launched Prime Music last Thursday. We covered the announcement of Prime Music on an earlier episode of The Drill Down, but they actually launched it last Thursday with more than 1 million songs. From artists including Beyonce, Britney Spears, John Mayer, Bruce Springsteen, Madonna,
Daft Punk,
Blake Shelton. It's available free for subscribers of Amazon Prime, which is the $99 a year membership program that Amazon offers to users. They, as we've covered on a previous episode, they're not focusing on the newest releases, and their music catalog is relatively small compared to other streaming music rivals. They have deals with Warner, Sony, and independent labels, but they don't have a deal currently with Universal Music Group, which is the world's largest music corporation. So
Amazon is
more bang for your buck, right?
Yeah, I mean, this is crushing it on the Prime side. Think about it. If you pay $8 a month for Netflix, you're paying $108 a year for a great amount and assortment of movies streaming. With Prime, you're getting a great amount of an assortment of movies streaming, plus exclusives on all the HBO stuff. And now you're getting all this music that you really probably would have thought about buying or like thought about doing whatever. And it's just sitting there in your account, ready for you to use album by album. You can't make your own playlists yet, but there are playlists that are out there for you. I'm in the car, I'm doing whatever. They've already set those up. And you can hit it album by album or artist by artist. So it's working like how your MP3 collection used to work back in the day. And then on top of all that, the music, the movies, you've got packages arriving at your door from things you purchased within 2 business days.
Sure. Sure. And,
Andy, you were talking some great stuff about like what this really means.
Yeah. So when Amazon Prime was first launched, it was sold as a premium service to get your durable goods, your physical goods to your door quicker and cheaper. And that was the initial enticement for Amazon customers, and people bought into that. And then they added on services like Amazon Prime Video and Amazon Prime Music. But I think that this is an insidious is a negative word. I'm trying to think of the
it creeps in slowly.
Yes,
that's kind of what it means.
The positive way to say this is really Jeff Bezos's way of you shouldn't think about Amazon Prime as a service to a premium service for the delivery of physical goods that happens to have these add-on content additions with it. You should think of it as a premium service for the delivery of all of this content, both physical and digital. It's a subscription service for the delivery of content.
Mm-hmm.
And that's Jeff Bezos's genius. Is he got his foot in the door, like literally his foot in the door with delivering your goods, and now it's music, it's movies, it's groceries, and more. Soon we'll see our goods delivered by drone.
Let's hope not.
This is the renewable subscription service. Just like Netflix.
Yeah. It's the Netflix of everything.
Yes. Yes. That's a great if Amazon if they weren't worried about giving free marketing to another company, that would be a perfect tagline for Amazon Prime. The Netflix of everything.
Yeah, we talk like the Prime Music, you're getting this music, it's not Spotify, it's not Google Music,
no.
It's not these things. But if you've been using Prime, you're less likely to get rid of it now because you have access to these songs that you would have otherwise had to pay for.
Exactly.
If you have been using Amazon Music, which I've been using Cloud Player, this just makes me feel a bit better about my Prime subscription and what it means, what I'm able to do with it. I'm less likely to drop Prime. And as an Amazon Music user, I'm less likely to think about going to Spotify because I've got my own music already in Amazon. Now I've got this playlist thing, so I may not have to buy some things I would have otherwise bought. But I'm a Prime user not just because of music. And I'm not dissing Spotify, Google Music, anything, because those things have very different purposes. If you're the kind of person who's like, let me just throw a playlist on. I don't need to find the indie artist that is super special. I don't need to make a playlist over the next 3 hours so I can play it when I do whatever. I just want to play something that's in this genre or that's associated with this band that I like. It's good for that kind of easy listening, for lack of a better term, kind of stuff. And that's what's pretty special about it.
Well, but not only that, but I mean, you're let's not discount the long view here. Is that right now, currently as it stands, Amazon Prime Music is not a Spotify killer, but that doesn't mean that it can't be in the future. That doesn't
right,
mean
right. But I wanna stop you for a second because I hear this word using technology all the time: killer, killer, yeah. killer, and I hate it. Because the idea that Amazon needs to succeed by killing something else is problematic. Steve Jobs said it best, right? Microsoft, you know, Apple doesn't need to hurt Microsoft in order for Apple to succeed, right? I mean, that's a paraphrase, but you get the idea. I don't even think that Amazon needs to kill anything in order for it to move forward. These are incremental steps to building a service that, again, is the Netflix of your life, the Netflix of everything, the streaming of everything, whether it's goods, products, music, movies, whatever. And I don't know that they need to chase down that dog. Yes, will you eventually be able to make your own playlist and choose your own specific songs on Amazon Prime Music? Possibly. But if it's anything like Amazon Prime Video, there's going to be limitations to what you can do. Because there always is. But that shows up initially when critical mass of users allows them to strike a deal with a music purveyor. I just don't think that we look at the word kill, and it's an easy word for the media to say, but it gets in the way of what's really happening, and that's creating a competitive marketplace with multiple players for multiple different types of users.
Sure, but and also like in the big picture, Jeff Bezos has never been about killing the competition. He's always been about, as you said, slowly creeping in and eventually becoming an undeniable part of your life.
Yeah, he's a power. Yeah, he wants to become a power player in your life. But I don't think Netflix is. I don't think Netflix is going away because of Amazon Prime. I think Amazon just became a tight competitor in that space.
Sure,
you know what I mean. And I think that Spotify, if Spotify is able to continually move and be nimble, they too will be able to exist without worrying about – I mean, obviously they're going to be worrying about their competition, but you know, they're not going to be killed off, just like how Pandora wasn't killed off by Apple showing up with their music radio service.
But also Amazon knows enough not to sit still. I mean, they recognize what the competition is doing, like Netflix, and they are doing things like, you know, their own productions, their own TV series. So they're also not standing still.
Yeah.
Shall we jump into the Amazon, the other big Amazon announcement?
There's an Amazon announcement? What?
Really? I didn't hear about it. What's going on?
So, as everyone at this point knows, this week at a special event, Amazon CEO Jeff Bezos unveiled their long-rumored smartphone, the Fire Phone. Equipped with Firefly, which is its standout feature, the Fire Phone will be able to scan and identify more than 100 million items, enabling users to perform instantaneous price checks, along with a contextual database searching everything from music and street signs to handwritten contents of notes and letters. Scan a song, it'll pop up an Amazon link. Scan a video game, it'll show you where to buy it. Scan a TV show, it'll offer a DVD, but also information about the actors in the scene from their Wikipedia page. It can scan phone numbers so you can put them in your contacts lists automatically. Basically, it takes a photo, scans it for the info, and just sends the details it needs back to the headquarters, and then that information is sent back to you. The other big feature of their new phone is front-facing cameras that give the interface a dynamic perspective. Basically allowing you to move your head back and forth and see a virtual 3D view of whatever's going on the screen. The way that this does that is it takes pictures 60 times a second of your face in real time, and it recognizes where your face is, where the location of your face is, and adjust the graphics in relation to that. It's very similar to a technology that Johnny Chung Lee was working on a few years ago with Nintendo Wii remotes.
Mm-hmm.
And now he's working with Microsoft, I believe, or Google, one of those two. But a Fire Phone is going to be priced at $199 for a 32-gig model and $299 for a 64-gig model, exclusively through AT&T for a two-year contract. What do you guys think about this?
We've seen new phones show up exclusively on AT&T before.
Yeah.
And they've done well.
that's an understatement. But, yeah, what did you guys think about the Fire Phone? And what was your favorite things about the Fire Phone?
For me, I mean, I'm not super crazy about the multiple camera hologrammy thing.
Uh-huh.
But I do like the idea that – so I looked at the idea of getting a Kindle tablet, the Fires, and – I like the idea of this kind of like thing in your pocket that has all this aspect.
I really like this Firefly feature because part of my world is taking pictures of stuff I see on the outside and then trying to find it so I can buy it when I'm back at home later. And I use Evernote and stuff, and I use reminders and stuff, and I use all these things trying to like remind me to go look it up. But if Firefly can do it for me right then and right there, that's great. And frankly, there are times when I'm sitting in a Target while my girlfriend is hanging out with my, my effective like sister-in-law buying clothes for her godchildren, and I'm sitting there bored, and I'm just taking pictures of Amazon's barcode scanner to see what I can get and I can't get. You know, are the prices cheaper or better? Exactly. And now I can do that in real time with like
brick and mortar stores. By the way, hate that.
Yeah. Well, you know, here's the thing. Brick and mortar stores say they hate that, but all the data shows that it just drives more purchasing in brick and mortar stores because the pricing is rarely that different. So if I can have something right here, right now, especially if it's expensive, and this is what Firefly is going to do for me. It's going to show me how truly expensive something is. And if I can buy it right then and right there, or if I don't really know about it, and even if the price differential is better on Amazon, I'm going to look at it, and if it's a bigger item, something I don't want to worry about shipping back, or it's an item that I'm not really familiar with, I like the idea that I can pick it up in that store, take it home, try it out. If I don't like it, put it back in my car and drive it right back. But if I do like it, I'm not going to go return it and then go to Amazon and buy it. So Firefly is going to help because it's going to help just me find stuff in the real – that's not in a store, just in the real world and see what it is and where it's available. If I see something on the street – and I realize I can get it. I can just pick it up on my way home from Target instead of like waiting 2 days for it to come from Amazon. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm going to do that. So I think that there's help for everybody here.
Yeah, no, I think I sort of agree here. I don't actually think I agree with the assessment that brick and mortars actually hate that. I think what, you know, I went to a conference
the showrooming thing is what they call it.
And yeah, I think what brick and mortars really would love to have is an understanding of what exactly a user is planning to do in their store. You know, there are different approaches if someone is doing price comparisons versus someone who's planning to buy immediately. So I think for me, in terms of like the kick-ass aspect of the device is mm-hmm. really that ability to quickly get a price check on something. Now, I think for me, that's actually like the only really unique
compelling
aspect of the phone.
Everything else came through. Everything else is what it's supposed to have.
Right. And everyone else already has. So it hasn't taken that step, that echelon. It is their first foray into the place. But, you know, let's see what V2 has to offer. I don't know if this is going to be that large of a thing to make current users switch. Right. I don't think this is going to cause iOS people to switch. I don't necessarily think it's going to cause the power-hungry Android people to switch.
You're exactly right. This is not – unless you're a crazy, hardcore Amazon Prime super person, you're not going to leave your iOS device for this because you can get most of your Amazon content on your iOS device. If you're a super hardcore Samsung Galaxy S person,
mm-hmm.
you know – that's something that you're also not necessarily going to run to the Kindle Fire Phone, the Amazon Fire Phone. But if you are a middle of the road consumer,
yeah,
who does have a Prime account or has been thinking about getting a Prime account, and this phone gives you these kind of perks, like, hey, you get this phone, you get a Prime account free or heavily discounted. Hey, you get this phone, and Amazon Music and the Firefly button, all this stuff was there. You're going to say, hey, why not? I think what this does is it kind of eats into the whole middle-of-the-road user. It eats into that big chunk in the middle that's not crazy hardcore about a Nexus or Galaxy device and is not crazy hardcore about an iOS device. The people who are willing to give it a shot. And it also gets more people onto that Prime situation.
Yeah, and I think
once they
also
get on Prime, they're not going to let go. Because the thing about Prime is that Amazon may have a Fire TV and a Kindle Fire and a phone TV, but you can get to their videos on a crazy amount of devices that are not Amazon branded.
So I think it actually what I kind of find compelling is it opens up the avenue for other things apart from searching for sales, right? So what if I'm around and there's this image which I know is from a particular movie and I have Prime and I'd love to just watch it immediately. It's something that I have. Oh, take a photo, bam.
You're like Big Booties Hoes 4, The Return, I'm watching it.
or if there's like, you know, the thing you see with Shazam, which is like song recognition. Well, what if I actually want to say song recognition and relate it to a movie? Like, oh, I've heard this in some particular movie. I kind of am compelled or interested in that. Can I be able to do something like that? So I think that's the evolution. And if they realize that evolution, that is incredibly powerful.
Yeah, that's pretty good. It's important to note that iOS 8 will have Shazam built directly into Siri, and Siri will be listening all the time. So there is some movement in this kind of like digifying analog meets space moments on the iOS side. But yeah, I think you're totally right. If Amazon can make it so that it's that easy for me to connect the dots between stimuli outside and following it up inside on digital purchases or digital consumption – then I'm pretty excited about what this has to offer. And, you know, I'm kind of hoping that they release some sort of Firefly app for other stuff, like iPhone and iOS and Android.
Now, you know what would have made the announcement one step better?
If Jeff Bezos had a toupee on?
Well, if Jeff Bezos had said, oh, coming now with Firefly is Firefly.
Why the TV show? Oh. What about like he's like, and also an Amazon Prime exclusive Firefly season 2.
Oh yeah. My god! Well, season 3, two. Right? Didn't they have two seasons?
No, just one season and a movie.
Oh.
He's like, by the way, one more thing, and then like Nathan Fillion walks on the stage, and it's like, wait, what?
And then like, blow it up. Yeah.
That would have gotten every damn geek in the world.
Oh yeah.
Like,
oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, that is like, you know, that would be definitely the killer app for Amazon Prime for sure. And they tried, you know, to hook into a previously established license with a Zombieland, but that was crap. It was really bad.
You know what would have happened? You know what would have been cool? I mean, getting Firefly production, everything back, that's really difficult. But we all know that Firefly was based on Cowboy Bebop. And what Cowboy Bebop needs is a great digital transfer, a digital version you can buy.
Sure.
So if you were like, oh, and by the way, Cowboy Bebop HD on Amazon Prime, drops the mic, walks off. And no muggle knows what he's talking about, but every geek is like, what?
That'd be awesome. Or, you know, let's just take another step. Community coming back, sixth season, movie, drop mic.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Not related, but, you know.
Okay. Thank you. I was like, wait, what? Crazy person. Community.
Community is coming back, I'm sure, at one point or another with somebody.
That was Spike Spiegel.
Anything else about Amazon's phone that you want to mention before we...
It is 4.7 inches.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's not a phablet.
No. I mean, it's bigger than an iPhone currently, smaller than a phablet, hits that middle side.
Yeah. Well, I think that's really conservative.
Like.
That's a good question. They didn't mention it. I think the 4.7 inches is a conservative size for their first outing, because you don't want to, go all in on it.
Into your Kindle Fire sales.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
No, I think it's I mean, I'm excited to see it. The Kindle Fire TV or the Amazon Fire TV.
Yeah.
There were some complaints about the functionality when people got their hands on it. Like, the software had not been fully finished, or at least it wasn't behaving as it did in the demonstrations or the sales materials. So with this Fire phone, they're really going to have to work to make sure that it doesn't become a reputation of theirs.
Mm-hmm.
Great announcement, product not ready. Now, the Fire TV got a software update pretty soon after it was released, and it fixed a lot of those issues. But still, it's something you don't want to have people remembering or leaving a bad taste in their mouths about. Also, when you get a phone, you know, it's a 2-year commitment, so.
Yeah. Yeah. Not too bad. 2-year commitment. That's standard for most cell phones. So, yeah, no, I'm anxious to get my hands on this and try it out. I'm not planning on switching. I'm stuck in the iPhone apps ecosphere, unfortunately, so I've got too much wrapped up in that. Maybe it would be good for a second phone if I needed such a thing. But, yeah, no, I'm really curious to check it out. Maybe I'll order it on Amazon just to check it out, and then...
Well, it's only $200 with a contract, yeah. So it's unclear how much it costs without a contract.
Yeah.
So keep that in mind. AT&T wants your money.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, there you go. Go to an AT&T store to check it out. Okay, we're going to take one last break here, but when we come back, drones that track your every move and why you might want that. And our drill down video of the week. So take a listen to this and come on back. Stay with me, my love. I hope you'll always be right here by my side. If ever I need you, oh my love, in your arms. So secure. You're listening to The Drill Down on Geeks of Doom. I'm Andy Cercini. I'm here with Dwayne DeFreitas and Tosin Anafowakin. So we have talked off and on about drones on this show. In one form or another, there are drones the government has in use and the military has in use. And then there are personal drones like the DJI Phantom, which is like the current market standard for camera-carrying drones. We're talking about camera-carrying drones, by the way. But there is a new revolution in personal drones on the market that are starting as a grassroots. In little Kickstarters here and there, and that is these drones that follow you autonomously. And Dwayne, you linked me to an article on Engadget about this device called the AirDog drone.
The AirDog is very exciting.
Yeah, yeah, the AirDog drone follows you autonomously via a watch that you wear. So you wear this watch and you...
It's basically a big RC GPS buckle.
Yeah.
So it's like a device that's like super simple, has like 3 buttons on it. So when you're doing your extreme sport, you can tell this drone to film you. It carries a GoPro camera on it, Hero 3, and it can film you without you having to worry about where it is or whatever. It takes this idea of... first-person extreme sport camera angles, and it makes it third-person, not unlike how the game industry changed from FPS to TPS when RPG showed up. So it's pretty exciting. It's hella expensive. battery life isn't great, but Kickstarter's for.
Yeah, like right now their Kickstarter is the standard entry for the actual device was $9.95 for an early bird backer level, and $11.95 for the standard AirDog with the AirDog with the Air Leash and the AirDog app.
And this doesn't include the actual camera that's doing it. It just includes the hardware that can fly the camera up in the sky.
Right.
It also has only a 15-minute battery life. Not great when you're trying to windsurf or something crazy like that, especially when you think about the fact that things got to get back to the shore. So you're getting 7.5 minutes in airtime and 7.5 minutes for it to get back to the shore if you're just keep on moving out into open water. But the cool thing is, it's designed so that it does know that it has to go back to the shore and land instead of just falling into the water.
Yeah.
So that's kind of cool.
DJI Phantom has similar technology in it too, although it's not autonomous. The AirDog is currently at 37 days to go with funding, and they are at $246,000 pledged of its $200,000 goal. There's another Kickstarter project with 26 days left that is at $665,000 pledged of a $50,000 goal, called the Hexo Plus. And the Hexo Plus essentially does the same thing. And they provide, one of the rewards is they will provide you with the actual device, or you can opt for a, you can opt for a kit where you can, 3D print your own. So you pay for the plans, and then you 3D print your own parts. If you want the kit, it's, $600. If you want the, if you want the fully built drone device, it's $600. If you want the kit, it's $300. And it's essentially sort of the same thing. They use very similar technologies between these two. The footage on both of these look great. There's one sort of hinky that I did not see either of them fully address, and that is obstacles. Like, say
snowboarding in the middle of a tree glade, like how
exactly
is it managing that?
Like, yeah. How does it avoid the trees? I think they've both of them have hinted that they're aware of that issue and they're working on ways to solve it,
which is why when you look at all the when you look at all the stuff, the footage, it's all like in the open water, or like, you know, mountain bike, you know, dirt biking or whatever.
We'll post a couple of the videos for these projects so you can see the footage from it, which is really impressive. Let's move on to our video of the week. And this is a video that I found this earlier this week and was like really fascinated by it from the beginning. There's a little story behind this, which is that in 1976, Sony introduced the Betamax VCR, which really kickstarted the whole idea of time shifting, of recording TV shows when they air and then using the VHS, the Betamax cassette, to watch it later on whenever you wanted to. This was time shifting before. This is the proto time shifting before on demand video, and it also ignited one of the first new media intellectual property battles. In the course of a decade, the Betamax completely disappeared, beaten by JVC's version of their cassette recorder, which played the VHS format tapes. And so this video is a story of how Betamax failed. I thought this was fascinating to me because it brings up these issues that are entirely relevant today in regards to format wars, intellectual property and copyright, digital rights management, all of these issues that were introduced essentially with this new media technology of VHS versus Betamax are still, in one form or another, with us today, with things like HD DVD versus Blu-ray and DRM. You know, the technological property issues that we are dealing with today sort of all stemmed from VHS versus Betamax. It's a fascinating video. It's like
one of my
minutes.
Favorite bands is VHS or Beta.
Are they?
Yeah.
So I encourage everyone to check that out. It's like a 4-minute video. It's Bill Hemmick, who is an engineer.
He's a super engineer. He's just like the best around.
Yeah,
what's
yeah,
cool
yeah.
about him as an engineer is that he's like a sales engineer. He can explain to you the issues. And as an engineer, he explains that the Betamax device was fundamentally more sound than the JVC device. The parts work better,
yeah.
has better quality. The issue was capability and format. And in the end, his conclusion is, I mean, you can watch it yourself, but you know, you only need to go so far to get the masses.
Right, right.
So there are people out there who say, oh, minimum viable product's a terrible idea. Make the best product possible, and that's it. And that's a great ideal. But when you think about just getting your stuff to market and having it really be adopted, you've got to think about minimum viable product with a focus on the word viable.
Right. And you brought up something after you're seeing this video, Dwayne, that reminded you of what's going on with the Fire Phone. It's not the best. It's not the first to market, and it's not the best product in the market, but it may be just good enough to eat a good portion of the market share.
Exactly, that middle market share that's not high end, that's going to take over that kind of super, not quite the low end, but that middle end. People, oh, I have Prime, let me give this a shot. 2 years into it, if the phone survives, the phone's good.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the functionality is going to be, you know, something that they may have really picked up on.
All right. I think that is going to do it for our show, with the exception of going around the table here. And I'm starting with you, Dwayne. Let us know, where can we find your work on the internet when you're not here on The Drill Down?
You can always check me out on twitter.com/DwayneD. That's DWayneD. I write it here and there for thedrilldown.com. And this week, you can download the Blendover podcast. And I'm on there talking about intellectual property and a couple other things.
Tosin, how about yourself? Where can we find your work online?
You can find me at twitter.com/toast4321, ircwebcast.blogspot.com, and I've been making some more posts for the toastr2d2.tumblr.com. Looks like I might get very close to finishing the dome this weekend. So.
Ooh, nice.
Nice dome.
I can't wait to check it out. How's the paint stuff coming along?
Oh, we've finished painting the parts for the dome, and those look lovely. There's going to be a whole post on that process coming up.
All right, cool. As for myself, you can find me at MrBabyMan.com, or just look me up on Mr. Babyman on Google, and you can find all of my social links there, all of my social links, Facebook and Twitter, Mr. Babyman, you can find it all there. Also, for the show, as far as the show, if you got a viewpoint on any of the stories we've talked about or any issue that pertains to technology, social media, or geek culture, send that story to submissions@thedrilldown.com for us to publish on The Drill Down. You can let The Drill Down podcast help you reach the targeted tech-savvy market of influencers and outliers that is our wonderful audience by writing to us at sales@thedrilldown.com. And be sure to catch us next week at the same time and location. And that's it for this episode of The Drill Down. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks.